This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Black Friday, the unofficial start of the holiday shopping season, is just over a week away. Now, you've dreamed of jewelry or a flat screen TV. Wake up. The way things are going, you might not even get socks or underwear this year. Or so says NPR's Robert Krulwich. He shared this tidbit Alan Greenspan told him about economic indicators.
If you look at the sales of male underpants, it's just pretty much a flat line. It hardly ever changes. But on those few occasions where it dips, that means that men are so pinched that they are deciding not to replace underpants. And he said that is almost always a prescient sort of forward example of here comes trouble.
With the Grinch-like economy, retailers have their fingers crossed, and they might have their toes crossed, too. They're holding out hope for some sort of Christmas miracle. Many big-box stores are already feeling the pinch. Target reported a big loss, and Circuit City filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Retailers, from mom-and-pop stores to national chains, are doing all they can to boost sales. Big, flashy advertising campaigns, deep discounts, holiday layaway plans. That's right, layaway is back. Retailers, we want to hear from you. What are you doing to woo would-be buyers? Our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Reporter Ilan Mui covers retail for The Washington Post. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Hi, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing, Allison?
I'm doing better than retailers, I suspect.
Aren't we all?
Yeah, retail is such a broad term. I want to narrow it down a little bit throughout the conversation. Let's start with discounters like Walmart, huge stores like Walmart. How have they had to rethink the way they position themselves as they're going into the holiday season?
Well, Walmart is actually in a really great position this holiday season because they are known for having some of the lowest prices on goods, on products, on whatever you might need. People think of Walmart, they think of low prices. In recent years, Walmart had tried to sort of get away from that a little bit. They tried to say, hey, we're Walmart, we have low prices, but, you know, we also have skinny jeans if you're looking to buy that. We also have fashion items. We can be a little bit upscale. But now they're finding that their low price strategy is actually working really, really well for them. And they've seen sales, October same store sales grew 3% when other competitors were reporting declines. So, you know, discounters are in a great position if they can offer that low price message that all kinds of cash-strapped consumers want to hear.
It's interesting you should mention that because Target had a little bit of a different situation. They had to switch up their sort of marketing plan once they realized they were going for losses. Can you tell us a little bit about what Target had to do and why?
Yes. Well, it almost seems like Target and Walmart have sort of switched places in recent months because Target had been known for having a lot of style. You know, they had clothes that were designed by top designers like Isaac Mizrahi. They had teapots that were designed by the top interior designers. So, you know, they really focused on style and fashion as the core of what Target was. Expect more and pay less. But in today's economy, they're focusing more on the pay less portion of their slogan.
They've switched so from Target. They've kind of
exactly
getting away from the Target.
Right. They're trying to get away from the Target, and they're trying to get more to the low prices because what they're finding is that consumers are cutting back on those discretionary purchases, those purchases of dresses, those purchases of the teapots, those purchases of nice pillows for your boudoir, right? And they're looking more for, where can I find the lowest price on macaroni and cheese? So what Target has really had to do is emphasize, you know, we sell the basics as well as selling the fashion pieces as well. And the reason why it's had to do that is because its sales have just been dismal lately. It reported third quarter earnings that were down 24%. So, you know, they're really seeing a hit at their bottom line.
What about the stores in terms of the suppliers having to make choices? Some of the big toy companies actually are charging more for their toys.
Right. You know, part of the problem that retailers face is that, you know, they don't order the products that you see on the shelves the day before they arrive in the store. They have to make these decisions about what they're going to sell, how much they're going to sell it for, how much they're going to buy months and months in advance. So when they were placing their orders for the holiday season, they thought that maybe the economy would be in better shape than it is now. They thought, they saw some weakness, but they said, you know what, I think Christmas is still going to come. What they're finding now is that Christmas is maybe on the fence, right? So that they've had to lower their prices on certain items, but also have to take a hit on their bottom line because they have to lower the prices in order for customers to get into their stores, but they might have purchased those products for more than they would have purchased them in previous years.
Let's talk to Leslie from Tucson, Arizona. We're discussing what it'll take to get people in the stores this holiday season. Hi, Leslie.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
My husband and I own a music store in Tucson, Arizona called the Instrumental Music Center, and we're teaming up with the Community Food Bank, and we're going to have a bring 10 canned goods or non-perishable food items for the food bank and get 10% off everything in the store. And we're just going to do it for one weekend, and it really is, for the first time, our first sale that we've ever had through the store to, like, discount prices. And it's also trying to help the food bank because they've had such a decrease in contributions over the last year.
When did you and your husband arrive at this decision that, you know, we really think we need to do something here?
I've been trying to kind of, ever since the election, try to figure out what I need to do as an American to help the economy and help my neighbor and all of that stuff. And I'm doing more with the Salvation Army, the adoptive family. I'm doing two big families instead of just one. And I thought that this would be a great two-for-one deal, both generate more income through the store, give people, you know, a break on prices, as well as help the food bank. So I'm trying to really think out of the box in terms of what we can do, and I'm hoping all of our fellow Americans do the same.
Leslie from Tucson, Arizona. I'm going to Tucson for Thanksgiving. What's the name of your store again?
Instrumental Music Center. We've been open about 10 years. We are truly a mom and pop. It's me and my husband opened it by mortgaging our house, and we're hanging in there.
All right. Well, good luck to you. Maybe I'll see you next weekend.
It's lovely, let me tell you. Right.
Thanks, Leslie. Let's talk to Julia on line 6. Julia is calling us from Oregon City. Hi, Julia.
Hello. Well, my husband has a regular job, but we also run a small woodworking business, and we're finding that this year the only way we're going to be able to give our kids Christmas is by doing bartering with other small businesses who aren't selling, you know, even half of what, you know, we usually would sell during a holiday season.
Oh, can you give me an example?
Sure. I was going to say I have twin six-year-olds who love, like, bath fizzies and lotions and stuff, mm-hmm. and there's another woman who has a small business where she makes those things, and so we're trading out us making a couple of cutting boards for her to use as gifts for her family, and she's making me these great bath sets with a bunch of the stuff that the girls will love to put together as gift baskets for them.
Well, that's a really creative way to work it out. Julia from Oregon City, thank you so much. Ilan, how are the bigger retailers getting creative about getting people into the stores?
Well, obviously, next week is Black Friday, which is the big shopping day after Thanksgiving, and they're really going to be pulling out all the stops to try to get consumers inside their doors. So one thing that I've heard, which I thought was just hilarious, is Best Buy is holding a contest. They held a video contest online for their customers to submit a video that shows why they love lining up outside Best Buy stores at ungodly hours of the morning to wait for the flat screen TV, to wait for the doorbuster deals, to wait for that $200 GPS or whatever it might be. So they held a contest for the biggest, you know, Black Friday fan. And in each market, they found one fan, and they're going to shuttle that person to their stores in a limousine and let them shop an hour earlier than everybody else. So they get to go to the store at 4:30 in the morning on Black Friday and shop the stores. So, you know, that's just one example of sort of the creative lengths that people are going to get folks inside their stores on Black Friday. I heard of another local retailer called Healthy Back that sells beds and whatnot, and they're going to be offering free massages to anyone who comes to their store. So, you know, the perks are many this year.
Isn't that sort of the first rule of retail? You just have to get the bodies in the store?
Get the bodies in the store. And, you know, that has been a problem for retailers lately. You know, I saw something today from a firm called ShopperTrack that tracks the amount of people who go to malls each week, each month. And they are estimating that traffic in the malls will decline by 10% this holiday season. 10% decline in traffic at the malls. So, you know, maybe good because you'll be able to find a parking space, actually, this year. But for retailers, they're really, really worried about numbers like that.
Let's take a listen to what Joe from Des Moines, Iowa has to say. Hi, Joe.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing? How's your business doing?
Well, I'll tell you what. Folks have talked to me regarding business for the last, we're a 48-year-old art supply dealer here in Des Moines. Been very well established here in this community, but in the last 9 to 10 months, we started feeling it last December already with our high-end luxury items. We sell fine writing pens and instruments, and once November 1st or October 1st hit, we had about a 30% decline right away that month. We had a good year going until November, December, but we are spending more time on the broadcast type marketing and advertising, and what you say about folks through the door. I promote add-on sales to my customer service people, but you don't have customers in the store, you can't even do a little where are the fries.
So the folks who are coming through the door and they're in your stores and you maybe don't see them so often, do they tell you why? Is it just basic bottom line, we can't do this right now, Joe?
Well, I think you're seeing that. I think the election had a lot to do with it. We also have a website, theartstore.com, and it literally, we can tell when people are watching the politics on TV. When Mr. Obama was giving his speech that evening, we saw web sales drop down to about 2 orders that night versus a regular 8 to 10 order night. And so I think there's a lot of distracted consumers right now that are being preached to by the media that they ought to watch their wallets, when the reality is, I think if we calm down a bit and just get back into a lifestyle and a routine again, we're going to see some of those customers develop their routines back the way they wanted to be. They can save their money. But they also have to remember that the independents out here, we really do need their help right now.
Well, Joe, we wish you the best during this holiday season. We're talking about what this holiday season is going to be like. How are retailers getting people in the stores? If you have a story, give us a call. 1-800-989-8255. I'm Allison Stewart. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington, D.C. Shoppers, they've been telling us they're not going to spend as much for the holidays this year. Not only do they expect to buy fewer gifts, the things they do grab will likely be less expensive. One survey shows part of the problem. A tenth of those who responded reported having trouble getting credit. That's not especially good news for stores. Retailers, we do want to hear from you. What are you doing to woo would-be buyers? Our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Ilan Moy is with us. She's a retail reporter from the Washington Post. Ilan, I want to read you two emails that we got. This was from Candace in Kansas. She says, we use layaway to pay off Christmas before the big day. It helps to curb some of the stress of the holidays, as well as keeping up out of needless debt. My only complaint is that the only department store offering layaway is Kmart, not someplace I would normally shop, but it's preferable to paying off Christmas 2 years from now. This is from Moore in Ohio. He says, Larry the Cable Guy was on Leno last night, and he said that things are so bad that he was at the dollar store, and he said they are now offering a layaway plan. Ba-dum-bum-ching, the joke. But I have seen the commercials as well for layaway. Is layaway the new big thing?
Layaway is making a comeback, definitely. You know, your emailer was correct in that Kmart is offering layaway. Kmart has offered layaway for many years. They're one of the few retailers who actually didn't get rid of the service. Walmart got rid of layaway about 2 years ago. As it said, consumer demand for the service weakened. But as we're seeing this year, the demand has come back. Kmart is owned by Sears Holding Company, and Sears just announced this week that layaway will be back in Sears stores as well. They saw the demand. They saw the long lines at Kmart. So Sears decided to bring it back. And, you know, what I thought was really interesting was I was actually at a Kmart talking to some folks who used the layaway service a couple of weeks ago. And what I was really surprised by was the number of people who still use layaway. A lot of them said they went to Kmart specifically because they knew the store still offered layaway. The line sometime would go down the toy aisle, you know, across the hallway. I mean, it was an extremely long line. People putting $400 or $500 worth of items on layaway, all Christmas gifts. So it's clearly still something that's very popular, and Kmart is definitely capitalizing off of it this year.
All right, let's take a listen to what Jim from Michigan has to say. Jim, you normally would be kind of in the holiday spirit, I take it.
Oh, I'm definitely ho, ho, ho in the holiday spirit. Being from the small town here in the lakeshore of Michigan, things are extremely bad around the area here. We don't have a lot of large industrial business. The only one that we do have isn't as bad as the automakers over in Detroit, but, you know, we're filling the pinch. And I do a lot of things in that white beard and red hat around the area.
You dress up as Santa?
I'll say that on air because only adult listeners are out there.
Okay.
I am the area Santa for credit unions, tree farms, all over. And everybody is telling me that wants Santa to come, you know, this year for his appointed rounds, that, you know, things are bad, Jim. You know, we've got to, you know, we're going to start, you know, and we're already seeing it. We have a little get-together for the mall Santas and things in the area. And we're starting to hear, you know, kids worried about daddy not having a job, about, you know, things aren't real good at home, you know. And one young man told me, he said, you know, he heard at a party that he did early was that the people, one young man was worried about having enough food in his belly. That's all he wanted for Christmas.
That's heartbreaking. Have you thought about the answers you're going to get to kids who come up and talk to you and have sad stories?
Well, I'll be real honest with you. I pray a lot, and I go back. When I put on that red hat, the magic comes, and every year I come up with an answer that seems to satisfy. You know, we have to tell them to have faith. We also have to tell them that, you know, things are up and down, and, you know, you do what you can. You work with the social agencies, you know, you get a name here or a hint there, and, you know, you try to help parents connect, too.
Well, go forth and be Santa-rific, Jim.
Oh, we will.
All right.
Have a very Merry Christmas, young lady.
Thank you
Good
so night. Much for calling. You know, we've been talking a lot, Ilan, about brick-and-mortar stores. What about what's going on online? Are they taking the same kind of hit, online retailers?
Online retailers are really facing a sort of different challenge. They've had so much growth over the past couple of years that a lot of retail experts were expecting growth to slow anyway in online sales. But they're seeing this year that growth is slowing faster than they had thought it would. That they're seeing, I saw one report today that said October sales for online retailers is expected to grow by only 1%. So obviously after several years of growing by, you know, 25, 26, 27%, a 1% growth is a very small number. However, it's still growth. So they are still seeing more people shop online. They are still seeing greater sales, just not quite in the same numbers than they had seen before.
Well, we'd like to bring into the conversation Joe Rideout. He's spokesperson for Consumer Action, a nonprofit consumer rights organization. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Allison. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, of course, because I'm going to mine you for information and advice.
All right,
so thank
plenty.
You for being on. You've been listening in on our discussion. What one or two pieces of advice would you give to people who are planning to shop online but really, really have to watch the bottom line?
Well, it's important. You know, there's a lot of great deal sites online like Fat Wallet or Slick Deals or a number of coupon sites. But it's important not to get carried away with buying items just because they're on sale or just because they're deeply discounted. It's important to remember always just to buy what you actually will use or actually need, especially if money is tight and you're looking online for deals. But, you know, that being said, there are a number of great ways to save money if you do a bit of research and check out some of the deal sites or coupon sites that are out there.
Well, do me a favor and define your terms, the difference between a coupon site and a deal site.
A coupon site would direct people to a coupon issued either by a retailer or a manufacturer. Say if you wanted to buy some Progresso soup that you can find deals through, say, Coupon Bar or coupons.com that'll give you 50 cents off cans of soup that are issued by the manufacturer, Progresso. And there are deal sites also that will direct you to not only coupons, but also just fantastic offers or unusually large discounts that are available at any given time. So those actually can save you the most money because most of the coupons are usually can be on the order of 10, maybe 20%. And they include enough restrictions at times that sometimes just looking for the deepest discounts can be the best offers. I'll give you an example. There's a Best Buy often advertises online coupons, but when you really read through the fine print takes up half the page, and there's a large number of restrictions. It says you can get 10 to 12% off of your purchase, except for TVs, copiers, cameras, computers, DVD box sets. I mean, what else are you going to buy at Best Buy except for these things? So watch the restrictions when it comes to coupons, and coupons are readily available through a great number of sites.
What's the best way to find them? I mean, you know, it's not like you go to your mailbox, your physical mailbox, and they fall out.
Yeah. Well, it depends on what you're looking for. There's a lot of great grocery coupon sites. Mm-hmm. The Grocery Game is probably the best of all, but it charges about $5 a month, but it does an outstanding job of targeting extremely deep discounts paired with coupons, so people can save a great deal of money through the grocerygame.com. Couponmom.com does a lot of the similar things that Grocery Game does, except it's free. The deals aren't quite as extraordinary, but it also tries to identify the best weekly circulars for grocery purchases. These are a great way to save money if you're buying non-perishable items that you can store up for a few months, like soup or cereal or other things like that. If you're looking for tech items or other kinds of gifts, Fat Wallet or Slick Deals have some tremendous coupon offers as well as just deals that they identify as being 50% off or an extremely good deal that combined with a discussion forum can inform you about whether this is truly a good price or if it's something people have seen last week or last month.
So, Joe, I'm going to ask you to hang on for a second because I want to go to Dan in Phoenix, Arizona, and bring him into the conversation because you're in web design, Dan, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I run a web design business in Phoenix with my brother, and we build all kinds of websites.
And how is your business at this point? Are people interested in opening up online stores?
Yeah, you know, I was a little bit fearful with the recession coming, but what I've noticed is that we've been writing more proposals and speaking to more customers than ever about websites. And even though there are plenty of clients I have who owe me money, who I can't collect from, and I understand their businesses are suffering, we're finding new clients. And I can only assume it's because probably a twofold reason. That one is I assume these businesses are looking for alternative ways to sell their products, and either they're looking to build a new web store, add one to their existing website, or they're looking for a whole new look and feel to their site because they want to gain new customers. And on the other hand, I started thinking that a lot of people are losing their jobs, and as a result, they're probably starting their own new businesses, and they're looking for new sites for their new businesses.
Dan from Phoenix. Well, I'm glad to hear things are going well for you. Thanks for calling in. Ilan, this brings up an interesting point. I'm not sure if you know the answer to this or not, but do you know who's faring better, websites for brick-and-mortar stores or web-only retailers like Amazon.com or eBay?
You know, it's not clear to me at this point. I would think that some of the benefits that a web-only retailer like Amazon would have would be that they don't have, you know, the infrastructure that a bricks-and-mortar retailer needs in order to supply their stores, et cetera, et cetera. However, I will say that, you know, overall, I think that consumers are looking for brands that they know, that right now they may be less willing to take a chance on a small online retailer, maybe one that doesn't have such a large name as Amazon or as eBay. So I think that people are right now sticking with trusted brands. The other thing about online sales that I wanted to bring up is that, you know, consumers' access to credit has also, I think, hurt online sales. You know, a lot of people are seeing their credit card limits reduced. A lot of people have defaulted on their credit cards, and so they don't have the same access to plastic that they used to in the past. And to make a purchase over the internet, what do you need? You need a credit card in order to make that happen. So online retailers are also watching the credit situation very carefully to make sure that to find out what's going on with their consumers and find out if they're having those problems with credit that would impact their sales.
Joe, before I let you go, you painted such a great scenario of, wow, there's all these coupon sites out there and all these deal sites. Can you just give us one warning, something that we'd make sure that people don't get taken advantage of in some way?
I think a timely thing to mention right now is rebates, because with Black Friday coming up, rebates are offered often by a lot of stores, even though some, like Best Buy or OfficeMax, have gotten away from rebates. There was a large rebate processing house called CPG that actually filed for bankruptcy last week. So we all know about how dicey rebates can be to begin with, but even for those who are rebate pros, who flawlessly cut out their UPC codes, people who submitted the rebates accurately nevertheless can be denied their rebates if your rebate processing house goes down. And that was the case for CPG, which processed rebates for, among other people, Costco, Home Depot, Canon. So there's even more uncertainty than before when it comes to rebates this year, because the rebate processing houses appear to be in distress.
Joe Rideout works for Consumer Action, a nonprofit consumer rights organization based in San Francisco. Thanks, Joe.
My pleasure.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're speaking with Ilan Mui, who covers retail for The Washington Post. We're talking about what it's going to take to get people in the stores this holiday season. And Ilan, you know, we've all saw the news that Circuit City went bankrupt, went to Chapter 11. If I'm sitting at home with a Circuit City gift card, am I just out of luck?
Well, you're out of luck maybe in the long term, but in the near term, they have said that they will honor gift cards currently. There are about 155 Circuit City stores that will be closing. So obviously, once those stores are closed, I wouldn't try to go there to redeem your gift card. But Circuit City still does have, you know, roughly 600 or so stores across the country. And those stores are still operational as the company undergoes bankruptcy protection. So the company has filed for bankruptcy protection, which means that it can continue to operate. It has not filed for liquidation, sort of Chapter 7, in which it would actually get rid of all of its assets. So, you know, the company's still around. I think that the bigger concern for consumers is how long will it still be around? Will it fall into Chapter 7? How many more stores is it going to close? And if I have a gift card or if I buy a TV with a warranty, are they going to be around to service that, you know, 2 years from now if my TV goes kaput, right?
Do you have any sources to tell us who we might want to avoid buying gift cards from for this reason?
Well, I wouldn't go to Linens and Things. So, you know, I think that the difficulty is that, you know, Circuit City was sort of one of the first to go, right? That they didn't even make it through the holiday season. They said, our business is so impacted right now that we're having problems getting merchandise to even sell during the holiday season. Our sales have dropped dramatically that we're going to call bankruptcy now, and we're going to try to make as much money off of some of these closeout sales as we can during the holiday season. I think in January, once some of the dust has settled for retailers, they'll be better able to assess, how did this season go? Was it make or break for me? Which side did I end up on? And that's when we may find out, you know, who we can shop with our gift cards still.
We've got two people I want to bring into the conversation because they're going back to some old-fashioned ways to get people in the stores. Christopher from Cleveland, Ohio. He says he's an executive store manager with Target, and we have gone back to old-fashioned customer service to drive sales. We've incorporated new procedures in place directly focused on pure guest service. And Linda from Burton, Ohio, this would get me into a store. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
So I should show up hungry to your store? Is that what I hear?
Absolutely. I work in a gallery called All Matters in Burton, Ohio, and we offer things like hot cinnamon apple tea and ginger snaps, and we're appealing to people to come and shop in our store. We have 55 artists, and we have things in all price ranges, and to get back to the spirit of things, like put your heart into it and come and spend a couple of hours, and it's just very restful. We gift wrap free. We just have we have a lot of different things to choose from.
Do you think it's helping you at this point? Have you seen a change in foot traffic?
You know what? We're doing really well, all things considering. And part of that is we have some very beautiful items here. In everybody's price range. And a lot of people these days are looking more for one-of-a-kind, not mass-produced items.
Linda from Burton, Ohio, thanks so much. And Ilan, as we wrap up in this last 30 seconds or so, it seems like value is the word.
Value is the word. I think that consumers this holiday season are focused on one thing, and that's price. Everyone has a 401k that's been impacted. Everyone has seen maybe their credit cards be affected by this economic downturn. And so the number one thing that consumers are going to be looking for is, where can I get the best deal on my gifts for this holiday season? And I think that is what retailers are going to have to provide for them. And they're really competing hard to try to get those customers inside their doors.
Ila Mui covers retail for The Washington Post. She joins us from a studio here in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for your time and sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, tanks, grain, and now $100 million in oil. How modern pirates are terrorizing the seas. I'm Allison Stewart. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Yesterday, the 25 crewmen aboard the Chinese merchant ship The Delight were captured off the Horn of Africa. Earlier this week, a Saudi Arabian supertanker carrying $100 million worth of oil was hijacked off the coast of Somalia. There have been some numerous attacks reported in the area this year, as high as 80, all by pirates. We'll speak in a moment with an expert on modern piracy, who they are, how do they capture these huge tankers, what's being done to stop them. And we'll talk with a reporter who spent some time training with pirates. If you would like to talk to either gentleman, our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Joining us now from Hippo Studios in Warwick, Rhode Island, is Derek Reverin. He's a professor of national security affairs at U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Derek.
Hi, and thank you for allowing me to share my personal views today.
Of course. In the case of the hijacking of the Saudi oil tanker, this happened miles, hundreds of miles off the coast of Africa. Is that unusual in terms of pirate attacks?
Well, it is, and it shows a level of sophistication that we haven't seen. And in East Africa in particular, these pirates that operate out of northern Somalia are particularly bold, where for any country to operate ships or attack craft 500 miles off a coast, it requires some level of sophistication.
When we talk about levels of sophistication, what are we talking about they have at their disposal?
Well, it's a whole network of probably thousands of people that work together. They the classic term is mothership operations, where the pirates will operate probably out of fishing vessels in the Gulf of Aden, and then they'll have really specially trained people that can find their target and then use small boats and conduct very quick raids and seize a merchant ship, as you described.
One of the big questions I've heard from more than one person is, how does a small boat take on a huge tanker?
Well, it's not quite a fair fight. It's typically, six small boats might surround a large tanker, and when you're the tanker captain and you're taking fire from automatic weapons and rocket propelled grenades, and these guys are boarding your ship, they have felt compelled to stop, because they don't have security teams necessarily on board.
Do you think that will change?
Well, I think we're starting to see that the international community has responded. The U.S. Navy and its coalition partners in the region established a maritime security patrol area, which essentially is a safe corridor for merchant ships, and they've had some success with that. The European Union has sent down some of its warships, but we're talking about an area that's four times the size of Texas, and it's a very large area, so simply sending American or NATO or Russian or Indian warships to the area is not going to solve the problem.
You know, to be clear here, we're not talking about a romantic idea of pirates. They're criminals. And do you think it's fair? I've seen this in a couple of places, to call them terrorists.
I don't think that's quite right. I tend to think about it more as it's organized crime at sea.
Organized crime.
They're a criminal network. They're operating out of an area where there is no effective government, northern Somalia, and in many cases, this group has really a monopoly on power in the region, and they bring tremendous economic impact to the region as well. I think this year the shipping companies pay the ransom. They've paid about $30 million this year, and in Somalia, $30 million goes a long way.
Well, that brings my next question. Is the goal ransom, or is it what's actually on the ship, the grain, the oil?
They appear to be associated really just with the ransoms, that they have currently about 12 vessels in Somali waters. Probably the most thought about is the Haina, which it's a ship that's carrying Russian tanks and small arms that the U.S. And other navies are watching closely. They don't appear to be stealing the cargo. That it's a business transaction. They seize the ship, seize the crew, and then they start the negotiations. And so they have, you know, at the high end from the attack, they can do these attack. But they have a very good support network ashore of accountants, negotiators, and people that make these electronic transactions happen.
Derek, we have somebody calling from Durham, North Carolina, who has a question for you. Hi, Eric. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
What's your question?
Well, I was in thinking about the challenges in protecting these ships. I know you have all these individual vessels going through a very large area of water. I was just wondering if there had been any thoughts of using some of the same strategies as they used in World War II, where it's rather than trying to protect a bunch of individual crafts, that they created large convoys with the idea that, you know, it's just as difficult to find 10 ships together as it is to find one ship together.
What do you think, Derek?
No, I think that's being tried with the Maritime Security Patrol area. They're not quite convoying because you're talking about a waterway that's heavily trafficked. The waterway connects Asia and Europe together. And when you're talking about the free flow of commerce, the idea that moves at its own pace. And so if the navies of the world got together and try to do these convoy operations, I don't think commercial companies would be ready for something like that.
We're speaking with Derek Reveron, a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. We've got an email from a gentleman named Guy, and he writes to us, "One thing I don't understand and have not yet seen a comment on is why the country/banks involved in paying the ransoms can't just follow the money. There has to be some big figures that are behind the fishermen pirates. Why can't the world just go after the top bosses, the recipients of the ransoms?" Do you have any thoughts?
That's a great point. I would just say you can look at the issues of money laundering and drug trafficking in general and see that governments have attempted to go after the money, and that's probably a key issue. But because the national banking laws, some countries are easier to bank in and facilitate transactions like this that occur.
I want to bring in Peter Gwynn to our conversation. He's here in Studio 3A with me. He's a staff writer for National Geographic and has spent some time with pirates in Southeast Asia. And I know you had a thought about why not just follow the money.
Well, I mean, what Derek says is exactly right. I mean, it's harder than we would think to trace the money. I mean, there was just a report out, I think, earlier this week about the difficulty in tracing the funds for Al-Qaeda. They still haven't been able to sort of stop all the funding. So, you know, I think it seems like an obvious thing, but it's much more tricky than it would otherwise appear.
Now, you actually went through pirate training. Is that fair to call it that? Or some sort of training of how people become pirates? What exactly did you experience?
Well, I was able to meet with some pirates in Indonesia, and I asked the question that you asked earlier, was how does a little ship take on a big ship? And it turns out that's sort of a mischaracterization, a way to think of it. It's not really the ship taking on the ship; it's the guys on the little ship taking on the guys on the big ship. And surprisingly, these huge ships are actually run by fairly small crews. And the pirates in Indonesia, I think, I don't know exactly the model in Somalia, but in Indonesia, it's all done at night. And these pirates use the small boats to get in close to the big ships, and a lot of times they're, they get in the wake behind the ship. It's hard for them to see back there. It's hard for the radar to pick them up, and they follow the wake up to the large ship, and then they use grappling hooks and other things to get on board. And once they're on board, captains of ships have told me and other crew members, the game is over. Once they're on board the ship, and these guys are armed, and usually the crews are not armed, it's all over with. So the trick is to get close to the ship and get on. And once that happens, you know, it's all over.
From the pirates you met, Peter, who are they?
You know, that's an interesting thing. I think it's a mistake for us to talk about are they terrorists or are they criminals exactly, because it's a lot of different things. you know, one of the things that piracy, just to back up a step, one of the things that piracy has in common in all these places, in the Malacca Straits, which is the narrow channel between Sumatra and the Malaysian Peninsula, off the coast of Somalia, as well as the Niger Delta, another huge piracy hotspot. All of those have in common a there's instability in the region.
In the government.
There's plenty of weapons. There's a large measure of corruption generally, and then there's also an economic incentive. They're actually all close to shipping lanes. And in Indonesia, in the Malacca Straits, you really see three different flavors of piracy. You had these guys that I spent time with that call it shopping. They're shoppers, and they're after, you know, the cash and the valuables they can rob from the crew very quickly. It's sort of like knocking over a liquor store to them, basically. It's a quick night out. You go on, you hit the ship, you get off, and you make a few thousand dollars. Another model there is organized crime, much more organized. They want the whole thing. They want the ship. They want the commodity. It's very easy to offload things like diesel fuel, tin ingots, believe it or not. There's a big market for that in the pirate community. And sometimes the ships themselves, they turn the ships into these phantom vessels where they change the nameplate, they reflag it in another country, and they use it actually as part of their operations. The Somalian warlords have done quite a bit of that. And then the last flavor, I call it, in the Malacca Straits was separatists. In northern Sumatra, you had the GAM insurgency fighting for independence. They used a similar model to the Somalis. They wanted to take fishermen ransom and hold them for ransom and use the money to fund their insurrection. And I have to say, you know, we were talking about, you know, what are these guys, it's organized crime and whatnot. You know, I think it's important to remember and go back to the fact that piracy emerged in Somalia and certainly the northern part of the Malacca Straits in large measure in response to the fact that foreign fishing trawlers were coming into their waters and scooping up, you know, small fortunes in fish.
And they lost their livelihood.
There's no government there to protect them. And so these guys armed themselves and went out and confronted the fishermen, the foreign fishermen, and started demanding a piece of the action. Well, it's escalated now to where the fact that, you know, they can make mm-hmm. a heck of a lot more money than just getting a tax on fish.
We're talking to Peter Gwynn, staff writer for National Geographic. He spent some time with pirates in Southeast Asia. We're also speaking with Derek Reverend, a professor of national security at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I do want to go to a caller on line 4. This is Eric from San Francisco. Eric, what do you think about this conversation?
Yeah, I love the show, but a few minutes ago I heard you say that these are not romantic pirates, and I thought that was a judgment that I'm not prepared to make, and I think that part of the romance of the pirates has always been that they're outside the law, and I understand that they're dangerous criminals and they're not Disneyland Pirates of the Caribbean, but I think that people have always wanted someone to do something different. I'm sure that Saudi Arabia and Somalia are not perfect places, and I'm sure that the pirates serve some function that some people probably find attractive and maybe even romantic.
What do you think about that, Peter?
There's a little bit of the Robin Hood thing going on, and I went to some of the villages where the pirates come from, and there's a lot of payback money that comes back through. You know, one of the guys I had met had, you know, built a mosque in his town. You know, they definitely sort of take care of their own. There's certainly reports that that's what happens in the northern part of Somalia, where a lot of the pirates are reportedly coming from. But the idea that it's, you know, romantic is, I really have a hard time with that, because you meet these guys and the lives they lead are pretty dark, and the majority of them blow their money on you know, vices like, you know, drugs and prostitutes. And there's a lot of, you know, it's to sort of romanticize it is a real mistake, because it is a major problem, and it definitely has global implications, and you know, and that's just the wrong way to think about it, I think.
Eric, we thank you for your call. Derek, I'm going to ask you to listen to Julius from Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Julius.
Yes, hello.
Hi, so what point did you want to make about security?
Well, first of all, I love your show, and what I'd like to ask Pete is, why don't these big ships arm themselves? I mean, they're carrying $100 million of oil. Why don't they spend some money on security?
Derek, would that make a difference if they spent a lot of money on security?
Well, that's one possibility, but I think in the short term it has the potential to really escalate the violence. And as Peter mentioned, these are relatively well-trained individuals, and when you have small crews that operate modern commercial ships, they don't really want to escalate the violence, and when you start taking casualties, that's not appealing for anyone. And that's why typically after the ship is seized, there's not much of a fight there.
Let's talk. Let me get to Rich in South Bend, because he's got on this thought. Hi, Rich. Hey, Rich, can you hear me?
Like that oil tanker that was hijacked recently, a super tanker, it's kind of hard to hide a ship that big. What would stop like NATO getting together, sending a couple of destroyers out there and just grabbing hold of it and taking it back?
All right, Rich, thanks for the question. Do you have thoughts on that, Peter?
Well, like Derek said, you know, escalating the violence. I mean, you're talking about a you know, in some cases these are chemical tankers. There's ammunition on the Ukrainian ship that was delivering weapons that was hijacked by the Somalis, has tons of explosives. Then also you risk the crew. I mean, you can go and take the ship, but then everybody dies, you know, and the cargo is lost and the ship is lost. So the ship owners are really they don't want to go down that road. And that's why the ransoms are paid. The ships are worth a lot of money. The cargoes are worth a lot of money. That's their number one interest, to get it back. The other thing about arming, that was a great question, and that's something I asked a lot. You know, why don't you give your guys, you know, some automatic weapons and you can fight back? Because a lot of times the pirates are lightly armed, at least in Southeast Asia. It's knives for the most part. A few times guys talked about carrying guns. But the answer to that is that there's other issues. And in addition to what Derek said, you know, there's the fact that in the Malacca Straits, you're either in Indonesian waters or you're in Malaysian waters, and those authorities don't want ships armed. In fact, there was a big scandal where some wealthy guy who owned a yacht was trying to sail through the area. It's a, you know, reputedly dangerous place. He was caught with an automatic rifle and put in jail, and it took a long time of negotiations, you know, to get the guy out of jail without facing a long prison term.
Derek, I'm going to give you the last question quickly. What's the solution? Is there a solution?
Well, I think in the short term, establishing the safe zone and increasing the number of warships. But the long term is to really understand that piracy begins ashore. And so it's a very difficult task to try to address the issues of Somalia. The government does not control the territory.
Sure.
These groups fill the void of the government by providing resources, and they have somewhat popular support.
Big political issues there as well. Derek Reveron is a professor of national security affairs at the U.S. Naval War College. Thank you, Derek. Peter Gwynn is a staff writer for National Geographic. Thank you for sharing your stories and reporting. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington.